started.
Okay. So yesterday we gave a little bit of a outline of some of the issues in Kisui Hadam and a little bit of an introduction. So now to try to take that a little bit further and perhaps to put it in a context and to try to see how some of the parts may come together. So when we began yesterday, we considered the question of how do we view the mitzvah of Kisui Hadam, which, as with everything we've discussed in the past few weeks, probably intertwines with the question of what the mitzvah is about, what is its purpose, what is it meant to accomplish. But one way or another, so we have to try to figure out where the mitzvah fits in. And we saw that it seems to be associated closely with the mitzvah of Shechita, not only because it comes up in the context of Shechita, but because it probably speaks to the purpose of the mitzvah itself. And that requires understanding the role of blood in the Shechita process. Is Shechita itself defined by draining as much blood as possible? Is that how we have the most painless death? Or is that itself why we have a prohibition of eating blood? Is one connected to the other? And where does Kisui Hadam link the two? So that discussion was behind a lot of what we considered yesterday. And that's what needs to be understood better today as well. So the Rambam, when he discusses Kisui Hadam, as you saw from the various references, so he places it in the end of Hilchos Shechita. And one could pose the question as to what exactly can we determine from this placement. And this is something that Rav Asher Weiss discusses in one of his essays in the Sefer on Chumash, in Parshas Achrimos, where he poses the question, is this because indeed it is a crucial part of the mitzvah of Shechita? It is the Gemar mitzvah Shechita, it's the end of the mitzvah, so therefore it's there at the end of Hilchos Shechita. Or is the Rambam simply being practical and saying, okay, this is a mitzvah that is performed at the end of Shechita, so therefore let's place it there in the halachos, because as you're going through the steps, you're going to end up with this mitzvah. So this, he thought, was behind the machlokes that we discussed yesterday, the question of the bracha, the rush in the beginning of the parak. The Rush quotes from the Bahag that normally we make a bracha before a mitzvah. But here the Bahag says you should make the bracha after the kisui, because otherwise it's going to be in the middle of a mitzvah. And his understanding being that kisui is a part of the process of Shechita, and therefore, if you're going to make a bracha after the Shechita, but before the Kisui, that's the middle of a mitzvah, that doesn't make sense. So therefore, it makes more sense in this case, unusually, to have the bracha afterwards, after the mitzvah is performed. And the Rush himself disagrees, and the Rush says that this is a separate mitzvah, and therefore you can make the bracha before the Kisui, because not in the middle of anything, it's its own section. So here, I have to figure out exactly what this machlokas is about. It highlights the connection between Shechita and Kisui Hadam, even though in practice we don't accept the Bahag. The bracha is made before the Kisui. So that position isn't accepted. But what exactly does it reflect? Because if it really was one mitzvah, so then why would you make a second bracha at all? I don't really have mitzvos that have more than one bracha unless there's something that justifies that. So, for example, when it comes to bris milah, so there we have two brachos because one of the brachos is understood to be for a different purpose, understood to be a berachas hashavach, and that perhaps we find in a few other places as well. But as a general rule, you don't have more than one bracha per mitzvah, although this is what to figure out about how that manifests itself in general. So therefore, as Rav Asher suggests in his presentation, that really everyone agrees that there's two separate mitzvahs here, and that's why there's two separate brachos. The question is how to conceptualize that mitzvah. Is that mitzvah essentially Shechita part two? Or is it something else? Maybe it's just a completely different function. Maybe, for example, if you're saying it's just there to prevent the isser of eating the blood, so maybe they're not really even connected. It's just something that comes up after Shechita is over by the nature of the process, but it's not really a part of the mitzvah itself. So this is interesting also because it affects a number of other issues, and especially if you read Rav Asher's essay there in Kiseitze, in Achrimos, so you'll see that he ties this into a lot of things. But one question the Beis HaLevi asks in his Tshuvas and Chelek Beis and Siman Yudala, the Beis HaLevi brings up the question that if the Bahag is correct, that it doesn't make sense to make a bracha in the middle of a mitzvah, so then we already have a problem when it comes to Kisui Hadam. Because Kisui Hadam requires actually dirt on top of the blood, but also beneath the blood. So the part beneath, that's prepared from before. And then the blood lands on it, and then you add another layer on top. So if you're going to make the bracha then, so already you're in the middle of that mitzvah. It's not just the middle of the mitzvah of Shechita, the way the Bahag and the Rush was being quoted, but even within Kisui, you're in the middle of the mitzvah because you started the Kisui from the beginning. So the Beis HaLevi assumes that the idea of dirt on the bottom is not a part of the mitzvah. It's a t'nai for the mitzvah. It's a condition for the mitzvah. That in order for the mitzvah to be fulfilled, you need to have this in place. But that's not a part of the mitzvah. Just like, for example, when a woman goes to a mikveh, so she has to make sure that she doesn't have any chatzitzas on her. There's nothing on her that's going to intervene between her and the water. So getting rid of the chatzitza is necessary in order for the tevila to take place. But you wouldn't say that that's a part of the mitzvah of tevila. So here too, having the dirt there as the foundation, that's a necessary condition for the kisui. That's not a part of the mitzvah. So that's how the Beis HaLevi understands it. But Minchas Asher, he poses this as a question, how exactly to relate to the lower level. And he suggests that it also ties into the general issue here about the relationship to Shechita, because if that is a part of the mitzvah, having this lower level of dirt, so then that's already happening during the Shechita, so there's more of a case to be made that that is a part of the mitzvah of the Shechita itself. So far, so good? Makes sense? And this could also be connected to another issue that the Rush there discusses, because the Rush brings up the question of hefsek and brachos. That the question of one of these processes or the other, you have a shechita and a kisui and a shechita and a kisui and a shechita and a kisui, let's say if you have a lot of animals happening at once, and if that's the way you're doing it, so is the shechita interfering and causing a hefsek as far as the process of shechita is concerned, and vice versa? Is the shechita that's happening in between the kisuis, is that a hefsek as far as the brachos are concerned? So the Rush first assumes that they should be parallel, that if you have a shechita in between kisuis, maybe that should be a hefsek just as vice versa. But then he says, really not comparable, that having a kisui in the midst of shechitos, that's not a hefsek, because the kisui is the completion of the process of shechita. So it's not some irrelevant action happening in the middle. While a new shechita, one could argue, maybe that's different. Maybe that's not really relevant to the previous kisui. And maybe that's going to require a different kind of analysis. So that's also an interesting question. Now, as the Minchas Asher also discusses, so is that a tension in the Rush? Because the Rush said that you make a bracha before Kisui against the Bahag because it's a separate mitzvah. But now here he's saying it doesn't create a hefsik in between shchitos because it's a part of the mitzvah of shchita. It's the completion of the mitzvah of shchita. So is that a tension? Is that a stira? So he sharpens it a bit. He says, no, it's not a contradiction. Because what the Rush would mean is that it's the completion of the act and the process of shchita. But it's not part of the mitzvah of shchita necessarily. So you could have it as two distinct mitzvos, like the Rush said, while still recognizing that the act of kisui is connected to the process of shchita, and therefore it's not some extraneous act which would cause a hefsik, which would have a problem for the brachos. It's an interesting discussion. There's a sefer, Mishkan Shiloh, which is a collection of essays of Rav Shiloh Raphael, who is a great dayan in Eretz Yisrael, passed away a while ago. I remember meeting him as a child. My father took me to hear him. So they published a sefer of his essays after he passed away. So in the sefer Mishkan Shiloh, so he talks about this question about, is one a hefsik for the other, the kisui and the shchita? And if not, why not? How exactly to relate to that? It's also interesting that when we talk about hefsik, so we're often talking about a concern of speaking, right? That we shouldn't interrupt with speech in the middle of an action or in the middle of a bracha or the like. So in the Shulchan Aruch, in Yerideya, in Yitess, Dalet, so there, the Ramah quotes that it's mutter to speak in between Shchita and Kisui. There's no Isser Dibor. But then he goes on to say that Mikol Makom Tov Shlo Yidaber. It's still, it's better not to speak. So you're allowed to, it's better not to. What exactly is the issue there? So once again, Minchas Asher says he thinks that that reflects these two possibilities, that according to the idea that it's okay, legamri, to speak, that is representing the notion that you have here two unrelated mitzvos, while the idea that really it's better not to speak, so that's reflecting the idea that maybe there is a continuity here, and therefore to whatever extent you can preserve the continuity and not interrupt at all, that would be better. That would be more appropriate. Okay? So far, so good? So we also discussed yesterday the question of to what extent is there a obligation specifically on the shochet. The Gemara makes it clear that the primary responsibility is on the shochet, and if the shochet is not the one who does it, so then society as a whole does it. But primarily it's on the shochet, and we saw some indications that there is a strong parallel here between this and bris milah, where the primary obligation is on the father, even though if the father fails to do the milah, then anyone else in society can pick up the task. So how exactly does that play out la halacha if the shochet wants to have somebody else do it? And we saw that this comes both as a privilege and as a responsibility. So that if someone else were to steal the opportunity, somebody else were to cover the blood before the shochet could get to it, so then he's got to compensate the shochet. He stole his mitzvah, so to speak. That's where the Gemara here introduces the concept of a sari zehuvim, of a penalty to pay for doing this. While, on the other hand, it seems like it's not just his privilege, but it's his responsibility. And we saw that the question was discussed, is okay for him to say, let somebody else do it? So we saw three views of the Shach, who maintained that, no, he's really got to do it himself, and the Shach takes the same view in the context of bris milah, which has not been widely accepted or at all recommended nowadays. But that was the Shach's view in both cases, while the Tvu Ashor was of the opinion that You could give it to somebody else if it's done b'toras kavod, if it's a way of trying to honor that person, so then it could be legitimate, while others focused on it being at least a function of shlichus, that it has to be a mission from the shochet, because the shochet, it's still his responsibility, so the only way he could get somebody else involved in an appropriate fashion is if he does so b'tara shlichus. So a number of achronim who consider this question in the later generations, so they try to figure out, what exactly does this mean? That the shochet is the one to do it, ideally. Is that a zchus kedima? It's basically a privilege that he has? Or is it, like we're seeing more, not just a privilege, but it's his mitzvah, it's his chiyuv? So this is an issue a number of svarim consider. Rav Asher, in this essay, so he also assumes that this is all a part of the original question. That if you understand that this is the completion of the mitzvah of shechita, so then we say, hamaschil es ha-mitzvah omrim lo gemar, that it's your responsibility to finish the mitzvah that you started. So really, it's not right to palm it off on somebody else, essentially. And as we discussed yesterday, especially if we see it as integral to the heter that comes along with shechita, that it's a part of the logic of the shechita and its process, so then all the more so, it makes sense that this should be the responsibility and not just the schus of the shochet. While if we understand it as something which is really a part of the process, it's just the next step, so then maybe there's more of a tzad to say, okay, so the shochet is the one who's there, the shochet is the one who is standing as part of this process, so it makes sense that he should have kedimus, but it's not necessarily a part of his obligation per se. So it's interesting also that we mentioned yesterday that most of us don't really partake in Kisui Hadam too often, and if at all, and the relevance is less than some of the other mitzvos. Pasu B'chalav is much more a part of our daily life than Kisui Hadam is. But there are certain principles that are derived from here to other mitzvos. So one of the interesting dinim that comes up that the Mishnah has over here is that what happens if you would cover the blood and then the wind would come and blow away the dirt. So now it's uncovered. So what happens? Is your mitzvah canceled? Is it undone? Do you have to do it again? Right, so you saw the Mishnah? What's the story about that? What would you think the story should be? So it's interesting here that the din is that you are not obligated to recover it. It's an interesting question. It's maybe a question of how predictable it is, that if you know the wind's going to blow it away right away, that's one story. But let's say you cover it in a reasonably secure fashion, and then there's unexpected wind that comes and blows away the dirt. So the Mishnah says you're not obligated to cover it again under those circumstances. So, what does that tell you? Is that the expected conclusion? So, you probably would have thought that if the point is this is connected to the issur of eating blood, the way the psukim seem to tell you that you should have the blood out of sight and therefore out of mind and out of access. So, what would you have thought? You would have thought, probably, it's got to stay down, it's got to stay covered. So this is interesting. Rav Asher discusses this as well in his essay. He talks about a lot of things all within this framework. And he connects this to an issue we were talking about yesterday. And so yesterday, we discussed the question that we find that the Kisa Hadam is kind of at a midway point between two extremes. That on the one hand, it's separate from Shechita enough that if you have Shechita without Kisui Hadam, the Rama tells us the meat is still mutter. It doesn't impact the heter of the Shechita. But on the other hand, if you know that you're not going to be able to do Kisui Hadam, you're not allowed to Shecht in the first place. So if you don't have any available dirt, so it's connected enough to the Shechita that you can't Shecht without the dirt being available, without the possibility of the mitzvah of Kisui Hadam. And the question is, why should that be true if one accepts the often quoted Mordechai, that when it's impossible to do a positive mitzvah, that shouldn't hold you back from what's connected to it? So his context was, if it's Shabbos and you have a garment without tzitzis, normally you shouldn't wear the garment without tzitzis, but on Shabbos it's impossible to fix the situation, you're allowed to wear the garment. So why don't we say also, if it's impossible to do the Kisui Hadam, so okay, you're not held responsible for it, and you can do the Shechita without the Kisui. So as we discussed yesterday, you see that it's somewhere in between, that it's separate enough from the Shechita that after the fact the meat is kosher without it, but it's connected enough to the Shechita that you're not supposed to do the Shechita if you know you're not going to be able to do it. So why is it different than tzitzis in such a clear way? So we discussed some approaches yesterday. Rav Asher in his essay over here, so he suggests that the issue is that this is not just a mitzvah. Right? Let's say tzitzis is a positive action that you do for its mitzvah value. But Kisui Hadam seems to be a more result-oriented idea. So there, it seems to be the focus is on the reality that you should have the blood covered up. So therefore, if you can't do tzitzis because it's Shabbos, you can't attack. Okay, so you miss out on a positive mitzvah. And there's nothing you can do about it. So fine. But on here, when it comes to Kisui, it's not just a positive mitzvah. There's a reality that's not going to be addressed in the process of the Shechita, that you're going to have the uncovered blood there. So therefore, that's not acceptable. It's not a situation you can get yourself into. And parenthetically, we mentioned yesterday that Tfilas Kelim is an area where this comparison needs to be defined a little bit, and that's why there's a lot to talk about. If you say it's Shabbos, so let's say the mikvahs are closed, as they were recently, or still are in some situations, so what does that say about your ability to use kelim if you can't perform the positive mitzvah of the tefillah? So here, this distinction, to say that the purpose is this reality of having covered blood, so it's a little surprising, or it's a little bit not a perfect fit, the din in the Mishnah, that if you do cover the blood, and it gets uncovered, and the wind blows, so then that's not going to obligate you to do it again. So if it's about the reality, so you would think you do have to do it again. So to that, the Minchas Asher says it's got to be a gzeiros harkasuv, that you're right, logically it's not what you would have thought, but that's the way the pasuk is understood, and therefore it's a gzeiros harkasuv. But it's interesting, this is also something which maybe is a general mitzvah principle, and this is something that the Kadjigal of Rav discusses. The Kadjigal of Rav was a great and very creative thinker who was a student of the Avnei Nezer of the Sachachav Rebbe. So the Kadjigal of Rav wrote the Tshuvas Eretz Tzvi, and in the Eretz Tzvi, so he discusses this in the context of other things. And he borrows a phrase from a different mitzvah. A mitzvah is actually a mitzvah derabbanan, not a mitzvah in the Torah. But we find this in the context of something you would not be thinking about right now at all, totally different area of halacha, and that is hadlakos neros. That we know that when it comes to hadlakos neros Chanukah, specifically, that when it comes to Chanukah, so we have to light candles, and the candles are supposed to be lit for a half hour at least. But lahalacha, we assume that what that means is it has to have potential. So if you're going to use an insufficient amount of oil, so it can't last a half hour, that's a problem, and you would not be yotze. Or, as the Rishonim extended, that like we saw here, if it's a very windy place and you know that there's no chance it's going to last more than a few seconds because the wind is going to come in and blow it out, that's also a disqualifying problem. But what if you have a secure place and you have enough oil or candles that are long enough and you light it and it happens to be after a few minutes it goes out? So what's the din? So it's a machlokus in the Gemara in the second parak of Shabbos. But the way we assume is kofsa, if the light goes out, lo zokukla, you're not responsible for it. You're not obligated to relight a candle that went out. So the Kadjik Lavarav discusses from there. He says that, is that something that is specific to Neris Chanukah? A lot of Sfarim discuss that in the context of Chanukah to explain why it is that the mitzvah of Neris Chanukah, which you would think is all about having candles that are visible, it's the whole purpose. So why are you still Yotze even if they're not visible? If they went out right away, you're still Yotze. It's a little surprising. So the way the Kadjik Lover discusses this, says in general that is the Torah policy. That when you have a mitzvah, you're only obligated to do it once. You have to do it in a solid way, so it's not likely to become or inevitably going to be undone. But if you do it in a solid way and it does become undone in ways that weren't so predictable, so then that's your responsibility. We have to define what your chiyuv is, and it can't be infinite. So therefore, essentially, the rule is, once you perform the mitzvah, it's done, even if it becomes undone by circumstances later. So he discusses that in the context of Kisui Hadam as well, and believe it or not, in the context of Mila, because the Gemara in Vamas discusses that what would happen if the body would develop in such a way that the Mila would be covered up. So you have to do it again. So yes, but that's a din derabanan. So it seems like it's not part of the mitzvah of Mila specifically. So he says, in general, this is the rule that you only have to do a mitzvah once when it's a one-time mitzvah. And he uses the phrase from Hilchos Chanukah to express the principle in all contexts. By all mitzvahs, kavsa lo zakukla. If light goes out, you're not obligated to relight it. This is, that's the same din that we find here, that if the blood becomes uncovered, you're not obligated to recover it. But it doesn't necessarily mean that that's a function of the logic of the mitzvah. It means that that's simply a Torah policy, and as Rav Asher puts it here, it's a gzeres hakosev, that there is only an obligation to do it once, even though it's true that the logic may indicate that it wouldn't necessarily be sufficient. Okay, so far so good? Okay, so a very recommended reading to read Rav Asher's essay in Parshas Achrei Mos, where he makes many of those points that we just mentioned here. But let's also now, just to maybe just end with this point, to address the issue that Ari brought up yesterday. Right, so I said we would get back to it. You mentioned at the end yesterday the very unusual p'tur, or the very difficult to understand exclusion from the mitzvah of Kisei Hadam. What was that? You want to re-mention your question from yesterday? Or your horror from yesterday? Right, what that...
That the pasuk singles out that it's a chaya and an oaf that is chayav and kisei adam, but seemingly to the exclusion of a behema, which we know is chayav and shlita, but presumably would not be chayav and kisei adam.
Right, so that's a very difficult point. And it's true that that's the language of the pasuk. The pasuk says chaya and oaf in talking about this obligation of kisei adam. And it's very hard to understand why. Because if it's a function of shechita, so then why shouldn't we assume that this should extend to a behemoth also?
Behemoth doesn't seem like there's any obvious reason why it should be excluded from the mitzvah of kisui. And if we look at the Gemara on Daf Pei Dalet Amud Aleph, right at the beginning of Kisui Hadam, so the Gemara explains it. I should say explains it with quotation marks because it gives us a little bit more, but it still leaves it a very baffling halacha. And the halacha that, as we'll see in the next few minutes, many of the later Svarim took it on themselves to try to explain a little bit, but they had a hard time. So here, the Gemara on Daf Pei Dalet Amud Aleph, so if you take a look, so the Gemara raises what you might have thought is maybe the more likely reading here. Okay, so the Pasuk only mentions Chaya and Of. So it says the Gemara in the middle of Pei Dalet Amud Aleph here, Amalei Yaakov Minor L'Rava, Kaimalon, Chaya B'chlal Behema L'Simanim. So in other areas of Halacha, so we find that if we use the word Behema, so we also include within it Chaya. So the word Behema does not exclude Chaya. It refers to both. So you could have thought, you would have been very understandable in thinking that it's the other way around also. So Ema Nami Behema Bechal Chaya L'Kisui. So let's assume also that the Behema is included in Chaya, just like the other way around. Chaya is included in Behema, so Chaya includes Behema also, going in the other direction. L'kisui. So when we're talking about the mitzvah of kisui, so the Torah names a Chaya and an oaf, but maybe Chaya should include Behema, which, for a lot of reasons, is intuitive. Right, because, like you said, so if it's tied into Shechita, so you need Shechita for both. And also, even just the language of the Pasuk. So, if you just had the word Chaya, so you'd probably think it's not necessarily exclusive. It could include Behema also. And adding the word Oaf, so you say, okay, well now it sounds exclusive, because if we're naming another category and we're not naming Behema, so maybe Taka, that shows us that it is exclusive. So you could have said no, because Oaf is really fundamentally different from Chaya and Behema, and it's a whole question how to relate to the mitzvah of Shechita when it comes to an Oaf. It's machlokas if it's Minat Torah or not. So you could understand why the Torah needs to also mention Oaf, because that's not as obvious. But if we say Chaya, so that should include Behema. And Oaf is the Chiddush, the Torah tells us that also. So you would have been on solid ground thinking that really what the Pasuk means is Chaya and Behema and Oaf. But no, Gemara says, no, it's not the case. So so the blood should be spilled to the ground like water, says the Gemara. So just like water doesn't require to be covered up, it's only blood. So too, Dam of a Behemah. Very difficult to understand. Right? So all that Gemara does is just kind of hammer at home that we're excluding the Behema against your intuition. But what exactly does that mean? That the blood is like water, it's halachically like water. It's very difficult to understand exactly how to relate to that exemption. The Gemara doesn't provide us with that much that is going to fill us in. So, first of all, one question is, the Gemara relates it to this pasuk called Aris Tishbechanu Kamayim, that it should be spilled like water. So where does that pasuk come from? So where does that pasuk found? So that itself is not obvious. It's somewhere in Sefer Dvarim. We get out of Dvarim here. So if you look at the Bar Tanura on the Mishnayos, so the Bar Tanura suggests, he understands it as being a pasuk in Parshas Re'eh. One way or another, it's probably going to be in Parshas Re'eh. But there's a couple of candidates in Parshas Re'eh. So the Bar Tanura points you to the pasuk in the context of Bechor Balmum. That if you have a, where is this parak? Tesvav. Tesvav Chav Gimel. If you have a Bechor,
that ends up being a balmum. So in the context of dealing with that, so the Torah tells you what to do with that and concludes, B'sharecha tochlenu ha-tameh v'ha-tohor yachtov, okay, rak es damo lo sochel, ala aretz tishbechenu kamayim. But you can't eat the blood, it should be spilled like water. So there you have that phrase, that you should spill the blood like water. That's the phrase the Gemara has. So maybe it's from this pasuk. So if you look at the Rashash on our daf, the Rashash on Peidalet Amud Aleph, the Rashash questions that, because it says, how would we know that if we're looking at a context of Bechor, so maybe it's because the Bechor starts off Kodesh. So we know that Kodshim are excluded from Kisa Hadam. So it's hard to know how to derive anything else from a context that's basically Kodshim. So maybe if you look at the beginning of Parshas Re'eh, and this also is kind of a good bookend to our whole year, because so we started off last Elul talking about Shechita, and now Kisa Hadam, the whole mitzvah, like we said, is the completion of the process of Shechita, but also now to go back to Psukim that we discussed the first week of Shir and Elul. So there, the Psukim, this is in Perek Yud Beis, so where the Psukim talk about, it's a little bit of a blast from the past, going back to the first week of Shir. So the Pasuk that talks about the heter of basar taiva, the heter of meat that is for your own personal interest, that's not only kachim, that in the Midbar, they didn't have shechita, and it's a discussion of the Gemara what that means, but one possibility is they weren't allowed to eat meat just for their own interests, during the context of the Midbar, and it was only for the Karbanos. So then, when they came into Eretz Yisrael, things changed. So in that context, Yud Beis Tezayin, so the Pasuk says, Rak Hadam Lo Sochelu, Ala Aretz Tishbechenu Kamayim. There's that phrase again, Ala Aretz Tishbechenu Kamayim. So the Rasha says, that's what we're talking about, and that's probably more convincing, because that's in the context of Shechita for the sake of eating it. But still, what's the nature of this drasha is very difficult. So why should it be? It's hard to see how they saw it in the pasuk. And what's the svara of excluding behema? Very, very difficult to understand. So the Torah Tamima has an effort. Torah Tamima back in Achrei Mos, where we are deriving the mitzvah of kisui. But it's difficult. He basically says something along the lines of, it has to do with the isser of eating the blood, and we need to be distanced from the blood. And behema is brought on the Mizbeach, and chaya and oaf are not brought on the Mizbeach, even though ofos some are, but he has a way of explaining why that's an exception. But chaya and oaf basically is not. So therefore, we don't have anything distancing us from the blood in the same way as we do the behemah. So therefore, we have to cover up the dirt. And cover up with dirt, we have to cover up the blood. So that's a little tricky still. And my grandfather, Zichrono Livracha, wrote a commentary on the Torah Tamima called Meshivas Nefesh. So he points out there, he has a lot of objection to this theory. He says it's niflamimen, this is very hard to understand how all the parts fit, and especially since this is an iser that's a chiyuv, that's not tied into the mizbeach at all. And he doesn't think the theory fits all the parts for a lot of reasons. And ultimately he says that this is a gzeiras hakasev, where we don't really understand it. It's hard to establish a reason. It is basically a gzeiras hakasev that we don't really know how to interpret. So if he just left it there, I'd say, okay, so thank you, Grandpa, but you basically left us with very little. Left to say, no, that explanation is not good. We're just stuck not knowing what it means. But the last few words, he has a very valuable maramakum, which opens up a lot of other points, that he makes a reference there to the Sefer Chassidim of Rabbi Yehuda HaChassid. So have that here. I'll share that with you. that if you look in the Sefer Chasidim, so the Sefer Chasidim of Rabbi Yehuda HaChassid, he makes a reference to Shin Ayin Beis. And that is a fascinating source where he has a whole different angle here on the mitzvah of Kisui Hadam Bechlau, on what the whole mitzvah is about. He comes at it from a whole different direction. And what he writes, I'll read it to you here, it's Shinayin Beis, if you'd like to look it up, says, Kisha Shochet Adam Chaya Of, if a person shechts a chaya or a bird, Yachshov Belibo, so what should he think when he does this? He says, Zeh Shalai Chacha, this animal, which never sinned, Nishchat V'tzolonoso, so here, you're going to shecht it, and you're going to end up consuming it. For Adam Shumali Avonos, and here you have a human being who is responsible for what he does, and he's filled with sin. Eichinat Sel Mishvichas Damim Umigehenim. How is he going to be saved from being killed himself and from Gehenim? V'yachshov Shetziva Kadosh Baruch Hu Lachasoy Stam Chayev Ov. So he should think in his mind that God commanded him to cover up the blood of this Chayev Ov. Pen Yomer Hamalach Hamamuna Aleihem, because we're worried that the Malach that is involved with these animals will say, Eich Adam Zeh Sholeichat Nishbach Ayidei Chayte Asher Chato Kishani V'Ktolas. Right, so how could it be that this animal who didn't sin, so his blood gets spilled by a human being who sinned a lot? So this is going to cause a problem for the human being who is involved in the shechita. So therefore, the mitzvah is to cover up the dirt. It's interesting, just as this invoking of the Malach HaMamuna, of whatever angel is responsible here. You may remember that this came up also in the context of Shiluach HaKan. The Zohar made such a reference that the purpose of sending up the bird was because there we want the Malach HaMamuna to say, oh, look at the bird, we worried about the bird, and the Kadosh Baruch Hu will worry about the humans in exile also. Here we want the opposite, that we don't want the Malach complaining on behalf of this animal, because what's that going to say about the human being who shechted it? So here, Stam, that's interesting because a whole different angle on the concept of Kisui Hadam, a whole different interpretation with a whole different symbolism. So that's itself interesting. It's itself a great Maror Makom, which I thank my grandfather for, because it gives a whole different perspective. But does it connect to this issue of why a behemoth is not involved? So here, that's an interesting question. So in the Moslet HaRav Kook, Sefer Chasidim edition, so you have a number of perushim on the bottom. So there's a mefarish, it just explains the basic context. And there's a commentary from the Chidah, the Bris Olam, and a commentary from Rav Reuven Margolius, who was a fascinating figure. He was a librarian who was a big expert in Sfarim. He wrote the Sefer Margolius Seyam on Sanhedrin. So here, the Perush on the Sefer Chasidim. So this point about the symbolism of the Kisei Hadam, so the Sefer Chasidim doesn't explain why it's just a chay and oaf. He uses the language of the Torah of saying that when you shecht a chay or an oaf, but doesn't explain why it's just them. So the Perush says, Ritzayin Olam Rabbi Shlomo Hu Shochet Behema Machma Shul Chelos Mishalo. Okay, if you shecht a behema, so this is an animal that's yours. Shemiskadela Salavuso. So you raise this animal, okay, we can understand you're going to come to shecht it and to eat it. That's, so to speak, you're right. So you have a wild animal or a bird, it was not something that you had to feed. So what right do you have to shecht this animal that you never did anything for?
and to eat it, etc. So therefore, all the more so, that's where you're going to come to this thought process, or where you're going to bring about this thought process, that it's not fair. Not fair. This innocent animal that you never did anything for, innocent both that it didn't sin and it doesn't have any hakar satov to you, you didn't raise it, and you're going to take advantage of it and shecht it. That's something that's very hard to understand. And that's going to provoke this whole thought process. So that's another angle. If you take a look on the other side here, the Bris Olam. So the Bris Olam is the commentary of the Chidah to the Sefer Chassidim. The Chidah, also a fascinating figure of Chaim Yosef David Azulay, great Sfardi Talmud Chacham, who was also a fundraiser for the yeshivas. So he traveled from place to place and collected all kinds of fascinating ideas in his travels. So he wrote the commentary on the Shulchan Aruch, the Birkei Yosef, which quotes from all over the place, and he wrote many, many svarim. So here is a commentary on the Sefer Chassidim where he refers to one of his other svarim. So he says that Hatam She'ein Mechasin Dam Behema. So why is it that the Behema you don't have Kisui Hadam? Says Lefi Tam Rebbeinu, based on what the Sefer Chassidim says, Sarach Lomar Kemosha Perish Harav Mefarishal. So this Perish that we just read, so the Chidah points you there, says Amdam Yesh Mei Razal Taimim Lekisui Chayiv Of. There are, in Chazal, other reasons for the kisui of the chayenof. Ve'ivesi divrayim b'sefer ha'kadim pesach inayim. So he also wrote a sefer that's organized on the daf called the Pesach Inayim. And Pesach Inayim, you can find it online. If you look on HebrewBooks.org, you can download a copy of the Pesach Inayim. So if you look over here in Kisui Adam, in Chulin, so he quotes other reasons. And one reason that he quotes is that when Cain killed Hevel, goes back to the very earliest days of humanity, that when Cain killed Hevel, so he just left Hevel there without burying him here, without protecting his dignity at all. So the Medrash, it says that the Chayos and the Ophos, they came and they covered him up, that they did what the human beings didn't do. They protected the dignity of the deceased Hevel. So it says, B'schus this, the Medrash says that, in this chus, so they got the mitzvah of Kisoy that protects their dignity, so to speak. I forgot who it was, somebody yesterday, I think it was Levi, drew the comparison to Kvura. So here the source supports that comparison, says that there is this association that the kvura that they did entitles them to the schus of the kisoy hadam, and that's why it's unique to them. And he quotes a few other ideas there also. Again, this is something you can find online. Pesach Inayim Manchulin, he quotes a few other ideas that make it unique to Chayanof and not to Behema. The Sefer Beis Matis Yo that we discussed yesterday, he has an approach also, is difficult. I don't know how to fully do justice to it, explaining it, but that Sefer is also available online. You can take a look. But there he fits this in with his whole approach that the Kisui Hadam is the completion of the process of the Shechita and the Heter Achila, and that somehow the domesticated Behema is more ready for Achila. So when you shecht it, immediately it's a Davar Meichel. But the Chaya and Oaf out there in the wild, it needs an extra space of separation between the Shrita and the eating to really make the statement that the blood has been completely separated from it and is not something that remains to be seen. So I don't know if that's any more of a clearer explanation than the Gemara gives. You know, the Gemara makes it clear this is the din, but and associates it with the Pasuk, but hard to see exactly how to relate to it, so I'm not sure how much that explanation contributes, but it's all a part of this effort to try to figure out why it should be. And it all goes to Ari's point that, yes, intuitively, you would have thought that this is not the case. Intuitively, you would have thought that Kisui Hadam should apply to Behema as well. As the Gemara says, linguistically, it's not obvious to us that Chaya should have been exclusive. You would have thought maybe that it could have meant both. But also, logically, for everything that we've seen, that if this is connected to the mitzvah of Shechita or the Isser of eating blood, or both, either way, very unclear why Behema should be excluded. It's
requires shechita. It's prohibited to eat its blood. It's very hard to understand why it's excluded. The Gemara doesn't tell us that much, so this is all a part of that effort to try to conceptualize why it should be. And I'll just close by mentioning that the last thing on the page in the Sefer Chasidim is Reuven Margolius's commentary, the Mechor Chesed. So he notes that according to the Sefer Chasidim's approach, that it's all about this thought process, so why do I deserve to live when this animal is executed, so to speak. So that's also why we find this primary obligation on the shochet. And it's all connected with the act of shechita, not just with preventing a michshol of the blood. So we can understand why the shechita is connected in this sense, and the shochet is the one who has the responsibility. And that would seem to lend itself to saying that it's more than just a schus, it's really a chiyuv on the part of the shochet, because it's really a part of what is evoked by that process. So this is, again, on many levels, a very appropriate bookend to our opening topic of the whole sugya of shechita that this mesechta began with, that it really complements the whole process, both the process of shechita and the mitzvah of shechita, and the themes that we started with at the beginning of what shechita is supposed to represent and accomplish. So this also bookends those themes as far as what this mitzvah is meant to accomplish, so it's very appropriate. So it's a good way to close our discussions of Maseches Chulin. God willing, tomorrow is our last day of Shir for June's month, but tomorrow is Parshas Korach, so we have to talk about the themes in the Parsha. Some very important themes, and especially as we continue into Tammuz and we look towards the 3 weeks, and we still hope that there'll be a Geula. We want to reverse it. We shouldn't have to fast on Shavuos b'Tammuz and to have the 3 week mourning period. So some of the themes connected to that are very much a part of Parshas Korach, as we'll see tomorrow. So just to quickly recap, so today we try to understand further what the mitzvah of Kisei Hadam is. We know it's part of Shechita in a sense. The Rambam puts it in the end of Hilcha Shechita, but is that, as Rav Asher puts it, is that because conceptually it's the completion of mitzvah of Shechita, or is it because it's just process-wise it's going to come up after Shechita? So that's where to put it. A number of issues were associated with that, such as the question of when the bracha should be recited, what the bracha represents, why the bracha is or isn't a hefsek, or why the kisoy is or isn't a hefsek within shechita. All of that, Rav Asher is assuming, is related here. And also the discussion of the focus on the shochet. Is that a schus? Is that a responsibility? Is that a chiyuv? How exactly does that play out? And we also talked about the idea that if it's uncovered by the wind, so then you're not obligated to do it again, as the Mishnah says. And we talked about whether that logically fits in with the idea, or whether that is more of a gzeiras hakasev, and maybe, as the Kadjuk lover understood it, a general Torah rule. You're only obligated to do mitzvahs once, but nonetheless, maybe logically, it is harder to understand. And then we also tried to understand the exclusion of behema, which is the impression you get from the pasuk. The Gemara confirms that impression, but doesn't really explain it, except through a gzeiras hakasev. The Torah Tamima makes an effort towards an explanation, which my grandfather pointed out is also difficult, and he thought it was a gzer sarkasiv, but he pointed to this Sefer Chasidim. The Sefer Chasidim, which was fascinating, said it has to do with the thought process that is evoked in Shemayim and in the individual, that why do I deserve to live with all my averus when I'm shechting this animal for my own benefit, and how some of the commentaries, the Mefarish there, suggests that that's why it's only by chai and oaf that you didn't even do anything for. You don't raise the animal and then you come and shecht it. Maybe behemah is a little bit more understandable. And the chida points to other explanations also, including this medrash about the role of the chayis and the ofos and the kvura of hevel. and a special schus for them, also connecting its mitzvah to the idea of kvura, as was suggested yesterday. And then we talked also about other interpretations, referring to the base matzisio. And then we mentioned also Reuven Margolius' point that all of this then helps to understand why the focus is so much on the shochet and not on anyone else. Okay, so we'll stop there. I wish you a wonderful day, and God willing, we'll see you tomorrow.
Thank you, Rabbi.
Our cult of... Bye.